Hello, dear listeners. I'm your host, Erin Gruwell, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. I'm so humbled by how well our book tour has been going the last 3 months. The Freedom Writers and I have been in schools and communities nonstop since September, celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Freedom Writers Diary with beloved readers, teachers, and students. With so many handshakes, high fives, and hugs, unfortunately, I've come down with something and lost my voice. But I'm so eager for our guest on this episode, I couldn't wait a single day to share his wise and poetic words with you. So I hope you understand. And I have no doubt our guest, an author who has promoted over 40 books himself, can sympathize about being up close and personal with fans, even in the midst of flu and cold season. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show, albeit a bit breathy. Today's show is episode number 44, featuring my conversation with renowned author, poet, and playwright, Gary Soto. With wisdom and wit, Gary recounts the academic struggles of his youth, his discovery of great poets and authors, and how he ultimately found his own life calling as an author with over 40 published works. Together, we explore the writing process and delve into the themes, images, and metaphors in Gary's work. This is an instructive and inspiring episode that will leave you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. Initially in my class, room 203, many of my students found it difficult to connect with the stories that we were supposed to read. After a lecture on Shakespeare, one of my students stood up and asked, "Miss G, why do we have to read books written by dead white guys in tights?" In that moment, something clicked inside of me, and I realized I didn't understand my students enough, where they came from, and what they were going through. But I needed to understand them in order to make the books and stories we needed to read relevant to them. So we started reading works by a diverse slate of authors about characters from a variety of backgrounds and upbringings. I sought out stories from Alice Walker, Amy Tan, and our beloved guest today, Gary Soto, to create a more inclusive canon which allowed my students to see themselves within the pages of a book. By reading Gary Soto's moving memoirs, short stories, and poetry, my students started to believe for the very first time that they mattered, that their lives and their stories were just as important as anyone else's, and that they could use their voices to not only change themselves, but to help others change too. In Gary, my students saw someone like themselves who grew up poor and underprivileged, but was still able to share his deeply personal stories with the world. With over 40 published books and plays in his repertoire, along with countless poems and anthologies, Gary Soto has been a vital literary figure for more than four decades. His work spans two extremes, from the minuscule portraits of life and humanity to larger scale issues such as teen murder, suicide, and living in America as an undocumented immigrant. Underpinning every one of his words is a recurring theme of empowering the disenfranchised, imbuing them with dignity and grace so they can be seen and celebrated. As you listen to this episode, I invite you to ponder how you can use literature in your own life to uplift and engage others. Without further ado, here is my inspiring conversation with the renowned author, Gary Soto. I realize this is an audio podcast, but I wish that you could see my smile from ear to ear. I am giddy beyond belief, and the hairs on my arms are literally at full alert because I am the ultimate fangirl right now. I am in the beautiful home in the majestic hills of Berkeley with one of my favorite authors of all time, the easiest author for me to teach to my beloved students, and that is the esteemed playwright, author, memoirist, poet, filmmaker, Gary Soto, who has in his lexicon over 40 books that span from children's books to young adult literature to adult memoirs and everything in between. And so to be sitting in his home surrounded by words and books that span decades and generations is any English teacher's dream. So without further ado, I am so honored to welcome to our podcast the esteemed author, Gary Soto.
Thank you very much, Aaron. It's a pleasure to have you in my house and also seemingly in your heart as well. So thank you.
I think what would be exciting for our listeners is to go back to that young boy in Fresno who did not have classrooms filled with your books. And the canon was very different as a young kindergartner. I know that your amazing book, Too Many Tamales, is in every elementary school library. But before your books were on those shelves, there was this five-year-old kid in Fresno who had great loss, came from an underprivileged community. What was that like to grow up without books and words that spoke to you?
Oh, well, true. We had two books in our household. One was the Bible and, strangely, a medical dictionary. I don't know what the medical dictionary was doing there, perhaps to heal us. I don't know. But it was absent that way, where there was no reference to the world that I knew, which was the world of just street living. And it wasn't a dark time, violent time. It was just that I was very much involved in just street life. I would get up in the morning and say summer, and I was out of the house at 8:30 in the morning, and I would return home for dinner, 5 or 5:30. So I had a lot of episodes out in the street, some good, some not so good. But this is where, you know, I think I did my tenure out in the street, just having fun, getting into little small trouble, never really deep trouble, but, you know, just a few things that would disturb my mom and stepfather.
You also experienced great loss at 5, losing your father. And I know that a lot of your poems, your books, your memoir deals with that loss. As a 5-year-old, did you understand that writing would set you free, or writing could be a way to pay homage to your father?
Later, I graduated from high school with a 1.6 GPA, so not so hot. And this was 1970, and if you didn't attend a college, either a community college, state, or a larger institution, you were drafted to go and fight in the Vietnam War. You know, the military is an honorable position for a young person or an older person, but it wasn't for me. And so I went to a community college, Fresno City College, which accepted me. And they said, well, yeah, take some classes. So I had a struggle. I had a struggle learning how to write. In fact, I jokingly say the first time I was ever assigned an essay was in geography. And I had a couple of topics like soil erosion, volcanic eruptions, and population growth. And I chose the third. And so my writing started off something like this, the essay. There are lots of people in the world, period. I look back, no grammatical mistakes, and then I advanced to the second sentence, which said, in our family, there are 7 of us, period. And then I thought, well, what else can I say? And I thought, oh, yes, the Romero family down the street has 9 people. Then I arrived at my thesis statement, which said, yes, there are lots of people in the world. Stupid, I would think. But, you know, it was a beginning. You know, I was like, okay, it didn't, you know.
But I want to paint a picture for our listeners. This beautiful boy from Roosevelt High School in Fresno, at the community college in Fresno, and suddenly you discover Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Pablo Neruda, and you're reading rich prose and poetry. What did those two authors do to you, specifically because they have these deep Latino roots? What was that like to read the prose and poetry, to go from your 4 or 5 word sentences, period, to realizing that you could use adjectives and adverbs and bring things to life?
Well, both Garcia Marquez and Neruda are just fine images. And this was probably when I was 20 at Fresno State taking a class, and I understood that the image is really paramount in prose and poetry. So I thought, well, gee, you know, if that's true, I'm going to be an imagist. And an imagist is someone who shows a picture on the page. And Neruda and Garcia Marquez, they're at the highest level of image making. You can't get higher than those two masters. So I thought, well, I'm going to try to read all their work and see if that feeds into my own writing. And I've always argued that you need models for your own work. And luckily for me, I found some extraordinary figures, and they've always been, you know, part of my reading life.
I think what's also so enlightening about your story is there's a reason. You weren't suffering in school because you didn't like school. Life got in the way. There was struggle. And I think that it's so important for teachers to know our kids' story. So what are some of the anecdotes of your story? As a kid in Fresno, you had a struggle to help with rent and food and all of those things in addition to homework, in addition to going to school every day. And I think it's really important for the readers to pay homage to your struggle and your success so that we can pay honor to our students' struggles and their success.
Very good question. I'm not a writer who really takes big positions in politics, big positions on the environment, big positions on the larger issues. I've really gone into myself, and it's evident in this poem. It's called The Bean Plant. And I'm just going to read you a portion because it gives you a sense of how I've gone into myself. You say you were 4 and suffering insomnia, that you lay in bed and sometimes crept to look at your brother, then returned to struggle with the sheets, thumb in your mouth for the taste of something solid. You say it was summer, that you could smell the iron-scented ruins of the junkyard next to the house, and then the mustiness of wet straw. Down the alley, a factory was making brooms. You were 4 and already thinking about the past. It was you, wasn't it, who planted bean plants in the yard and jumped up and down when the plants unraveled from their crumbs of earth? And it was you who created the waterworks for their survival, for the survival of ants, too, because they didn't require the smallest bead of moisture, did they? And so I'm looking at this poem, Bean Plants, and it's just how I planted bean plants. And it becomes a metaphor because the bean plants do grow, and their arms are out, as in to the left or right of their little stem. And I could see at that age, there's a metaphor working here. I didn't use the word metaphor, but I could see these bean plants are me. It was like, this is as ground level as I can get. This is as minuscule I can get in a portrait of a part of a Fresno in which the word poverty does not come up, racism doesn't come up, segregation doesn't come up. It's just me and the ground and a bean plant and seeing myself not unlike a bean plant. And there's around me, so it happens to be a lot of other bean plants.
For English teachers who love our craft and love words, I love that you went from being that student at a community college to going to Fresno State and deeper dive. You're now reading Frost and you're reading Hemingway and you're reading all of these iconic writers, Steinbeck. So you're reading rich poetry, but you're also reading great novels. How did that impact you when you were a college student at Fresno State?
It was one of the best times in my life when, you know, I was proud to carry around, say, a Garcia Marquez novel or a Neruda novel. In fact, I have a book when I turned 21, my brother gave me the selected works of Pablo Neruda. And I was, you know, I wanted to be part of the literary world and I wanted to show it as evident in the books that I carried and in the time I spent with the literature. Aaron, we have to realize that I was still grasping at the language. You know, trying to figure out how to write a graceful sentence and just looking really at the sentence patterns, the line breaks, how long sentences were. So it was really a private tutorial. I would just teach myself via other writers.
What I'm really proud of, I did my undergrad at University of California, Irvine, and in the halls of academia at UCI, they tout you. You went on to be the first Mexican-American to get your MFA at UCI in poetry. So what was that like to continue the studying from community college to your BA at a state school? Now you're at a UC school and studying poetry, and now you're in the annals of our history.
Well, yes, I am an anteater and a proud anteater. I think what happened at Irvine is that I moved there with a best friend who was also a poet, John Weinberg. He passed away about 2 years ago. We roomed together and we kind of fed off each other. We were going through college poverty, which meant a lot of frijoles and tortillas, and almost daily that was our meal. But it was so much fun just to be with another writer in the same household for 2 years. Again, it was just a matter of wanting to study poetry, wanting to participate by trying to publish in literary magazines. I was really, I'll use the word gung-ho, to kind of get myself into to magazines, both small and large, to show evidence to myself that I'm a writer.
Well, I want to give some evidence to our listeners. Your poem, Oranges, is the most anthologized poem in America. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that any young person in America can go through their high school career without reading Oranges. Would you do us the honor of reading this poem that every single middle school or high school student at some point in their curriculum reads, analyzes, dissects, deconstructs?
It would be my pleasure. The first time I went out with a girl, I was 13 years old, cold and weighted down with two oranges in my jacket. December, frost cracking beneath my steps, my breath before me, then gone as I walked toward her house, the one whose porch light burned yellow, night and day, in any weather. A dog barked at me until she came out pulling at her gloves, her face bright with makeup. I smiled, touched her shoulder, and led her down the street, across a used car lot, and a line of newly planted trees until we were standing before a drugstore. We entered the drugstore, the tiny bell bringing a sales lady down a narrow aisle of goods. I turned to the candies, teared like bleachers, and asked what she wanted. Light in her eyes, a smile starting at the corners of her mouth. I fingered a nickel in my pocket, and when she lifted a chocolate that cost a dime, I didn't say anything. I took the nickel from my pocket, then an orange, and set them quietly on the counter. When I looked up, the sales lady's eyes met mine and held them, knowing very well what it was all about. Love, I mean. Outside the drugstore, a few cars racing past, fog hanging like old coats between the trees. I took my girl's hand in mine for 2 blocks, then released it to let her unwrap her chocolate. I peeled my orange that was so bright against the gray of December that from some distance, someone might have thought I was making a fire in my hands.
Every English teacher in the world has dissected this poem. And when it first came in, it was in the book Fire in the Hand.
Yeah.
An anthology of all of your poems. Did you think it was going to be as well received to become, in contemporary literature, something that we would all respond to and teach and read?
No, I it's a surprise. Even to this day, and we're, 2019, almost heading to 2020, the poem is still acceptable to young people. I think this poem was written in 1983 or 84, and somehow it just has that that reserve of power to influence a new generation. So it's surprising for me.
You know what I want to go back to? When you were talking about your GPA at high school, at Roosevelt High School, and then you went to the community college, there's this stigma for kids about a numerical score, and it becomes a label. And what I love about what you went on to do is you took that GPA, which could have been a stigma, and you got advanced degrees, and then you taught. Mm-hmm. And you taught the love of words and the love of poetry to students in the halls of academia. And I don't think for you that high school GPA mattered because you overcame a numerical score. So can you talk about why it's so important for teachers who are listening not to stigmatize or stereotype our kids with those grades, with those GPAs? Because look at you, you went all the way.
You never know. And, writers many writers have had poor GPAs. But they discover something, whether it's poetry or fiction. And you're so sucked into that. You have no choice but to do this duty. And the first duty is to write as well as possible, or learn how to write as well as possible. And the second, of course, is to find your subject. And for me, the subject was evident. It's going to be childhood. I'm really going to look into my childhood, especially along the lines of the death of my father, sort of the split up of family, farm working, so the poverty that existed in the part of the world that I lived in. I was going to really expose that, not so much for the world, but for my own self. And if it had a readership that went beyond myself, that's fine.
But your Proverbs have these great images when you think of oranges and pennies and beanstalks. They're simple things that are anything but simple. And I love that about the way you write, is you take these very organic images and they represent people.
Well, I think that, Aaron, you hit on it. It's the image. And it goes back to Pablo Neruda and García Márquez, where they are probably the premier image makers of the past century, is that they're able to really paint a portrait in unusual ways.
But I want to pay homage to you, because I think what your sweet spot is your sympathy for people who may be underserved. Your sympathy is for people who may be on the margins or the fringes, and you embolden them and you empower them. Where does that love affair with emboldening and empowering the disenfranchised come from?
I know I could see an image in my mind. This is 1958, and I'm walking down the street, and there's a kid walking in the opposite direction. And I look down at his shoes, and the soles were flapping, and he had big holes in his socks. And then I looked down at my shoes, and they were the same thing. So it was kind of like I was passing my own image.
Like your doppelganger.
Like, oh my God, look at the kids. So, and I thought, gee, we're like almost mirror images. We're just like passing. And I think that affected me, that one image. I said, well, this is my rank and file life. This is this kid that I just passed is not unlike me. And it's been there ever since.
What is that like to know that writing leads to everything? Writing leads to songs we hear on the radio. Writing leads to the television shows we watch. Writing leads to the movies that we pay to go see. It all starts with a great writer.
Well, I think that what we call an adventurous writer, because I started off as a poet and then worked in prose, either memoirs or essays, then novels and for adults and young adults and the younger chapter novels. Now I've really risked myself by writing a musical. And this musical was called In and Out of Shadows. And In and Out of Shadows is about undocumented youth, or dreamers, as we call them. I did not want to do it. Emily Cleon, she's a director of the San Francisco Youth Theater, right here, not too far from where we're situated. And she says, Gary, write a musical about undocumented youth. I said, are you out of your mind? He goes, I don't want to do this. And he will apply for a grant. I think, oh, well, she'll never get it. She did. I said, Gary, you're going to write it now? I says, I guess so. And it turned out it was one of the hardest things I've ever done. It took me 3 years of hard work, 3 years for Emily, also hard work, cast, everything, in order to produce it. And it was a success. It was a sellout situation in San Francisco. And we went to different places, Fresno, Salinas Valley, the peninsula here in the San Francisco area. And I wrote the lyrics. I didn't do the music. I wrote all the words in this thing. But the end result is that it was labor. But again, I had the most wonderful reception. There was a ballet folklorico group out of Modesto who came to see it. They drove, this is like 90 miles. They took BART. And at the end performance, all the girls put on their ballet folklorico outfits. And they danced for me in the street. And so that, again, is kind of like really a high honor, that this has an effect on an audience, on a readership, on people. And it was just, I said, okay. So I said, okay, after about 3 years, we performed it another year, year and a half. And then I thought, I'm done with this thing. I don't have to worry about plays anymore. And then Emily Cleon then says, hey, Gary. I said, oh, no, more work. He goes, yes. Can you write a play about teen murder and teen suicide? I said, no. And then she says, I'm not going to use the word pestered, but she demanded that I write this. It became a play called The Afterlife, loosely based on my novel, The Afterlife. And it's played at different venues, and it's very, very strong. In fact, tomorrow we go to a dress rehearsal, and then we're taking the troupe, the San Francisco Youth Theater, to Bosnia in a week and a half to perform in a youth festival there.
I want to just marvel for a moment. For the kid at the community college who wrote 5-word sentences, period, and thought he was done, to someone who would tinker and toil for 3 years to get it right, walk away from one play and then tinker and toil for another play. Can you tell that kid in a classroom who writes those 4 or 5-word sentences, period, and thinks they're done, that writing is a process and that good writers tinker and toil sometimes days, weeks, months, in your case, years to get it right?
There are 3 major art expressions. There's applied art, as in drawing, sculpture, oils. There's music, as in classical, jazz, rock. And of course, there's the literary aspect. That's the essay writing, novel, poetry, and plays. For me, having, experience those 5-word sentences. And I thought, well, gee, I got those 5-word sentences down. Let me see if I can advance that and make it 7-word sentences, longer sentences. Hey, why not a whole paragraph? And so after a while, I was bitten. You know, in literature, we'll do that. You want to be part of the literary canon, whatever that might be. I never used the word canon in my vocabulary when I was 19 or 20, but I said, I want to write. And there was something inside, there was an ingredient already inside me that says, you're going to become a writer. And I didn't know, I said, oh, yeah, right. I mean, it's kind of like that alter ego. You're going to become a writer. Yeah, right. And then it happened. I started writing poetry. And then I found others who wanted to do the same thing. In other words, write. I found a teacher who shaped my poetry, another teacher who shaped my poetry. And then it became really a serious endeavor when you said, well, okay, I think I'm going to try to get an MFA, Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing. And I thought, well, I don't know, I guess I'll do it. And I did it in part because of my friend, my roommate, he joined me at Irvine. So it's a process. It is a long process. It is a life calling. And for me, it was really evident when I was 20, 21 years old, that this is what you have to do.
This is a perfect time for teachers and students alike, or our listeners who just love to write in their journal or dabble with poetry. Can you talk about the process in and of itself? Because in your home is so scenic and surreal with colors and scenery. What does a writer like you do when you wake up in the morning and you have a cup of coffee? Do you know what you're going to do when you sit down at a table to start writing? Tell us about your process.
Okay, the first thing I do in the writing process is worry. And I'm thinking of Meatballs for the People. I remember reading some proverbs. I thought, these are pretty wise. I wonder if I could write a couple of proverbs, see what that's like. And then it got addictive. I thought, okay, I'm going to read you 3 proverbs.
Please do.
Just show you exactly what I mean. A small plate, big buffet, builds upwards. With each lick, an ice cream loses its dome. If you roll like a wheel, you're still young. His mouth, a garbage can spilling its guts. Just 2 more. Financial aid application, harder than college. If you're paid by the hour, it's never enough. And so I thought, I'm going to write these little, in Spanish it's called dichos, and little proverbs, and see where I go with this. So I wrote over 1,000, and I thought, well, this is ridiculous. It's just, it kept going and going and going. And so I'd carry around. I no longer write longhand. But I, in this case, because of their brevity, I thought, well, I'm just going to just, you know, carry around a notebook and write these dichos as little proverbs and see what happens. So that's the process. And then you finish a book and you go, well, then there's the part of finding a publisher. And it's like the Shakespeare book, You Kiss by the Book, is that I went to the bookstore and I, lo and behold, there's Shakespeare. I'll just read a couple of his sonnets. And then you're inspired. You go, oh my gosh, I see something. I see a process here. And so I went home and began to look at my collected works of Shakespeare, which I hadn't read in many years. I'm not a Shakespearean scholar. I'm not a, I do like his plays, but I thought, I'm going to try to do this. So it's then becomes, I have to do it until I finish it.
I feel like you constantly step out of your comfort zone and you constantly reinvent yourself with words, which is probably really exciting.
It's, I do that. And I'm a child of the 60s, and the last thing I've been doing, and no one wants to participate, is that I've been writing song lyrics. And I'm thinking, boy, I'd like to find someone who could, who would like to work with me on creating the music and with my lyrics. The lyrics are sometimes sort of jazz-based in my mind. Some of the lyrics are country, western music in my mind.
Do you hear words in your brain? Like when you're walking around, do you get inspired and then you grab that pen, grab that notebook and jot something down? Or do you constantly hear those words poetically being woven together?
No, you know, when I walk around, I just do that. I just walk around. But when I'm reading, I'll read a poet or a novelist and I see a phrase in there. I said, this is genius. Not that I take that line, simply it inspires me as well. I said, this phrase making that occurs is, you know, it gives me fire as well.
Do you find that being a voracious reader has made you a better writer?
Absolutely, there's no question. You need to read in order to become a good writer. You need to maintain that skill of writing. You need to read. And not only that, you need to write. Some of the things I do after where I'm on a hiatus, where I haven't done anything for a week or 2 weeks, and I go back. And I go, oh my God, this is terrible.
It's like exercising the brain, right?
It's exercising the brain. I said, oh my gosh, you know, this is, because you throw it away. And I've thrown out a lot of work. And I have a fireplace right behind you, and I've burned some of my work too. I said, oh, I don't want anyone to know how poorly I write at this age of 67. I go, no, please, don't share that with the world.
If someone was a voracious reader and they wanted to be a Gary Soto aficionado, there are over 40 books that you have written, whether they were anthologies of your poems or your memoirs. What is your personal favorite book that you've written out of that 40?
No, this is easy to answer. It's Jesse. And Jesse is about two young men who are coming of age, 18, 19, community college. In many ways, it's autobiographical. In others, it's just simply invention. But there's a tone in that novel writing that I was never able to duplicate again. It was like, I'm not going to say it's a one-hit wonder, but it just, the tone is just, for me, you know, I can't do it again. And that was written in 1993, 94. I've written other novels since then, but that one is so close to my heart.
It's so ironic you say, because that was the novel I chose that I thought was perfect for my students.
Yeah.
Perfection.
Thank you.
When you close a book after you send it to your publisher, do you feel like it's done, or do you want to go back and say, oh, I wish I could tweak that or change that? Do you ever feel done?
I'm only done when after they copy edit and then they look at it and then I'm finished. I'm working on a book right now. I don't know if it's ever going to be published, but it's a good exercise for me as a mental exercise. It's called Sit Still. And sit still is how I behave as a person, as a man of my age at 67, where I can't sit still, that I'm out of the house three or four times a week, either during the day or the evening, seeing a concert, ballet performance, lecture, gardens. So I have 8 boxes of all the brochures, the programs of events I've seen. They're in my garage. So I decided as an exercise, I'm going to try to capture some of those moments when I'm outside the house and I do a little capsule review of each event. It is an exercise, both for memory and also sustain my writerly skills. And it's called Sit Still, and it's about my preoccupation about just going outside.
But I think you're clearly a Renaissance man. But what I love, especially when you were talking about being brought out of your comfort zone to write plays, what you're being asked to do is really monumental themes, paying homage to young people who are undocumented, to understand people who try to take their life in the afterlife. I love that you write things that matter and humanize and allow your readers to be sympathetic. That's an art form. And you don't rest on your laurels. So tell us about why these really difficult themes is where you thrive.
I work the spectrum, as I mentioned in the bean plants, where I'm at ground level, you know, looking at this bean plant that I planted by accident, because bean plants were my army men. And so I'd play with these pinto beans, and I'd play with them, and then I'd forget about them all of a sudden, because they're buried, they grow. And that's a really minuscule portrait of my childhood. And then, as you say, Aaron, it's the extreme where I'm writing about teen murder, teen suicide. You can't get any larger than that for youth. Those are moments that we read about daily. We see, we hear. And so I'm at the two extremes. And one of the responsibility is that minuscule portraits that I provide. The other is also to tackle really larger subjects, teen murder, teen suicide, or undocumented youth.
Do you ever get emotional when you're writing? Is there a way that when you're writing, you want someone who maybe is cynical or maybe someone who doesn't have the ability to lead with love to walk out of a performance or put down a book and see your perspective?
Yes. Sometimes I do get angry in my work, or I feel something of happiness or some mood swing that all writers, you know, go through. I have an essay, it's called, it's for California Rural Legal Assistance. They are a legal service that helps the rural poor, and there's plenty of those out there, and the injustices they often face. And it's actually quasi book review and quasi statement about farm workers. And so it's just the history of farm working in California. It's a long essay. It was published in a literary magazine. No one will ever read it, I don't believe. But for me, the whole act of writing was an emotional issue, in that the people who feed this nation, farm workers, are not honored at all.
So you give voice. You give images. If you could picture some young Gary Soto in some class, struggling with their language, struggling with their identity, struggling with the words, what kind of advice would you give that young person, either with pen in hand or with technology, to find those images, to find those words, to find themselves?
Well, first thing I would say is to this young person is, what is your weakness? And that if you could find your weakness, work on that weakness. And because the strength is already there. And then the second thing I would say is persevere, is that if you kind of like only give yourself a sliver of time to get better at whatever you want to do, that's not enough. I've been working at this craft of writing for 45 years, and it's still for me, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I hope I can get this thing done. So, and if it's a struggle for me after 45 years, when you're starting off 18 or 19 years old, give yourself some time and find whatever weaknesses that you find about yourself, work on it.
One of the greatest writers and teachers of writing who taught for years at the Iowa Writers Workshop, Joyce Carol Oates. I want to read something to our listeners that is honoring you. And I think there's no greater honor than another writer who knows the craft, who knows your struggle. She said, Gary Soto's poems are fast, funny, heartening and achingly believable, like Polaroid love letters or snatches of music heard out of a passing car. Patches of beauty like patches of sunlight, the very pulse of life.
That was very generous of Joyce. I met her once or twice, and I asked her, could you provide a blurb for my book? And, most writers don't want to, okay. But she was very kind, and bless her heart.
What does that feel like to get the accolades, the awards from your if people were to see the awards, you would need a warehouse house them. Well, yes, you do. I know this because this is my field. You have been awarded just about everything. What does that feel like?
I don't know. I think it goes back, Erin, to really the response of readers and the people that really I touch. And in the whole process, man, they touch me. I said, I get really teary-eyed when someone comes up and says, I've read Jesse, and I think it's a really good read. And I go, you read Jesse? That's my favorite novel. Or when we did In and Out of Shadows, there was a young man and a young woman in their mid-20s, and she was a teacher, and this guy was a young man, so he didn't want to say, I don't want to see no stupid play. And then she said, oh, you're going to go see it with me. So, of course, there was a new boyfriend, girlfriend, and he's behaving himself. So he goes and sees In and Out of Shadows, and it's a lot of comedy, but a lot of moments of which there's despair as well. And he didn't want to go, and he was the first one crying. And I'm like, well, or said, man, I wanted to watch the Warriors on the television. And he's the biggest baby in the whole darn place. And so that is the kind of response I want to see. That's the kind of honor or connection I want to see from my readers.
My last question for you is, there are teachers who are not inspiring their students. And if you could help every kid love writing, how could you become their teacher for a moment? If you could be the teacher for everyone listening to this, whether they're young or old, prolific or not, how could you inspire others to follow in your footsteps, to write what needs to be written? What would you tell us?
Okay, that's a large question to solve the problems of, not the educational system. I think just how people view literature. I would really have that student find an author who speaks to him or her. Find that person and, carry his book, her book around. One of the highest honors I received is I saw a little girl, carrying my book around. I go, wow, that's cool. And I approached her. I said, I wrote that book. And she kind of got scared. She's like, oh, dirty old man trying to talk to me. And,
stranger danger.
I said, oh my God. I said, wait, I already wrote that book. And but I think that, we should advocate, carrying books around instead of our phones. And I would say that find a writer who speaks to you.
I'm so grateful to Gary Soto for sharing his wise and poetic words with us. My dear listeners, may we each find authors that speak to our souls. May we identify our weaknesses and patiently persevere to improve them. And as our guest Gary Soto so poignantly embodies, may we use the power of words to bring others out of the shadows. During our conversation, you heard me refer to one of my freedom writers, Tony. Perhaps more than any other book my students read, the simple yet heartfelt story in Gary Soto's Jesse spoke to Tony in a profoundly unique way. As we conclude this episode, I want to share an excerpt from a speech Tony recently gave to an auditorium filled with ninth grade students who are the same age as Tony when he first discovered Gary Soto. In his speech, Tony pays homage to Gary and shares how he became an author just like his hero. Here's Tony on stage at Vista del Lago High School in Moreno Valley, California.
I'm going to be perfectly honest with you guys, and I'm just going to tell you straight off the bat, I hated to read. I know I'm not supposed to tell you guys that, but that's the truth. I hated reading. I hated books. I hated school. And the reason is because I felt like it just wasn't made for me. It wasn't made for people like me. But I do love to learn. Like, I'm a huge nerd. When I was a kid, I actually did really well. I got really good grades because when you're little, you want people to be happy. You want to get the little like happy face sticker and you want people to be proud of you and stuff. And then as you get older, people stop caring. So you're like, well, I'm going to stop caring too then. The reason I hated reading and the reason I hated school was because I felt like nobody cared whether I got good grades or bad grades. And I went from being in like smart classes when I was little to being in dumb classes by the time I was in high school. But the thing is that nobody in that class was dumb. Nobody was dumb. We were smart enough to get up on time. We're smart enough to make it to school. We're smart enough to take care of our little brothers and sisters. We were smart enough not to get shot. We ended up in that class because we simply didn't care. What happened was, I feel like I was given the wrong books and the wrong things for me. We read Anne Frank, the Anne Frank's Diary. Have any of you guys read that? When I read it, it wasn't hitting me. It wasn't hitting me right here. Like a lot of the freedom writers had this like amazing moment, but I wasn't feeling that, right? And I remember I told Erin, Miss Gruwell, I wasn't feeling that, and I told her, and she ended up giving me this little book. And it was called Jesse by a guy named Gary Soto. I looked at the cover and it had two teenagers eating lunch in the fields. And I was like, what is this? And she's like, oh, it's a book about this Mexican kid that leaves high school to enroll in college earlier. And he works in the fields on the weekend so he can pay for his community college. It's like, what? Somebody wrote that story? That's amazing. And I started reading it and I loved it. It became my favorite book, and I had this little book and I carried it with me and all that, because I didn't think that people wrote books like that. I didn't know there was Latino authors writing stuff like that for us, you know? So flash forward like years, 10 years later, we're doing an event kind of like this at a university in a library, and they invited like authors, right? So they invited us to go and speak. So I go and I speak in the morning, and it's like lunchtime. And I go up to the table where the food's at, and they have like one of those little bars where you make your own sandwiches and stuff, right? And I'm like sitting there, you know, and it's all empty. And this guy, this like Mexican dude, comes up with glasses and stands next to me, and he's like, hey, where are the tortillas? I was like, holy crap, you're Gary Soto. And he's like, yeah, you know who I am? Yeah, you're my favorite author, man. And then I take out my book, Jesse, and I show it to him. I'm like, look. And then he looks at it, and it's all like bent and messed up, and you know, it's old. It's like 10 years old, right? And he's like, you couldn't even buy a new one, huh? He's like, you want me to sign it? I was like, yeah, cool, man. Awesome. And he's like, okay, but only if you sign mine. You're one of the kids, right? The Freedom Riders. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, you want to sign my book? He had a copy of the Freedom Riders Diary. If you would have told me when I was younger that education was going to change my life, I wouldn't have believed you. Because I was always about, what is it gonna do for me right now? Those stupid little stories, those dumb little things that we took, we put them together, we made a book, it became a number one seller, and it's been translated in 15 different languages, and it's read all around the world. But more importantly, it helped us to change and to grow and to become better people. A lot of times you don't realize the effect that you guys are having right now on yourselves. But as you get older, you're going to look back and you're going to realize like all the amazing things that you guys did as you built your foundation to become better people.
That concludes our show this week. I'm so grateful to our guests, Gary Soto and Tony Becerra. And I want to thank you, our listeners, for joining us yet again on the podcast and being an important part of our Freedom Writer family. If you'd like to learn more about Gary Soto and his work, please go to the episode description in your podcast app and click on the link in our show notes. And if you were inspired by Tony's words, there's also a link to learn more about outreach events through the Freedom Writers Foundation. As always, we are eager to serve you in your school or your community. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Sirier and Rob Falk. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.